On Tuesday, February 4th, you and I got together and we heard from Neil Simon. He's a former independent candidate for a Maryland U.S. Senate seat. He got as high as 18% in his independent bid, and he took everything he experienced on the campaign trail and some ideas and wrote a brand new book about how to fix the American political system. And we went to one of our go-to guys on politics later in the show, Dr. Gary Rose, who chairs the political science department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. We talked about the current political landscape and the debacle that came out of the Iowa Democratic caucuses. Back here on Connecticut Today, right here at WICC 600 on the radio, and of course online at WICC600.com. Everybody always talks about how to fix the American political system, third parties and all that, independent runs, but it never really seems to happen in any great amount. Our next guest has some thoughts on that. He was an independent candidate for U.S. Senate seat in Maryland back in 2018, and at one point in a three-way race, he did poll as high as 18%. His new book is called Contract to Unite America, 10 Reforms to Reclaim Our Republic. We welcome author Neil Simon to Connecticut Today. Neil, how are you? Thanks for stopping by.
I am doing great. Happy to be with you.
Thank you, Neil. Appreciate it. You know, I'm so glad we have you on today because I don't care what year it is, Neil, whether it's 2020 now or we heard this in 2018 when you ran or 2016, probably back to the founding of the country here. You know, we always hear that warning. We've heard it from our founders about partisanship, yet we seem to be locked. For whatever reason, we can go into that. We seem to be locked in kind of this two major party dichotomy. And as often as people say we have to get out of it, we seem to be in this grip of it that we can't figure out what is a better way to go ahead here.
It is. And a lot of it is a function of the incentives in our political system. So we've allowed our political system to be re-engineered over the last few decades where our politicians have really almost no reason to do anything other than appeal to the extremes of the two parties, appeal to the bases of the parties that are the active voters in primaries. And that's also where a lot of the money in the system is. So a lot of what my book's about, and the book is called Contract to Unite America, is about the incentives in our political system. And it's told through stories from my campaign and from other campaigns around the country.
Now, you ran as a third-party candidate in Maryland as recently as 2018. Talk a little about that. What was that like?
So I ran as an independent, unaffiliated from any political party. And in your opening remarks, Paula, you talked about how our founders did not envision political parties. There are no political parties in our Constitution. And a lot of us lose sight of that. Our founders had actually envisioned a government run by independent politicians who had loyalties to their constituents and to their country, but not such deep loyalty to political parties. And many of them feared what we have today, which is a political system with politicians with much more loyalty to party leaders and parties than they do to their country or their constituents. And the book is really about how we can change it, to what's happened in the last few years to get us from a much less polarized political system to where we are today, and then what are specific reforms that we can get around to change that political system.
Neil, though, how much of the grip that political parties have on us, how much of that is to be blamed on the voters themselves who maybe don't push hard enough, Neil, for change or don't seek out an alternative to the D's or the R's? How much of that is the voters' fault?
Some of it is the voters' fault, but I actually think more of it is the fault of politicians and lawmakers. You've got to decide, do you believe that we are an inherently very divided country, and then as a result we're electing divided leaders, divisive leaders, or do we have a political system that encourages our leaders to be very divisive and polarizing, and then they're out there demonizing each other, calling each other evil and stupid, and as a result, it divides the rest of us. And I think it's more at the latter than the former. I spent a lot of time on the campaign trail, and I spoke to thousands and thousands of people. And most Americans are tired of the blue versus red warfare. Most Americans don't identify as either devoted conservatives, which is only 6% of the country, or progressive activists, which is only 8% of the country. Most Americans are in the other 86% of the country where they're tired and they want better results from our government.
You point out something I know I've actually discussed on this program, something that AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, recently said, Neil, and I don't agree with a heck of a lot of what she says. I do think she's a really good politician. Her rise to power, her rise to prominence, her fundraising prowess, I think, proves that. But she said something about the lack of a true home in the Democratic Party for people like her, which I thought was actually a pretty eye-opening thing.
The interesting thing about it is, why is she part of the Democratic Party? Why is Bernie Sanders part of the Democratic Party? They identify as Democratic Socialists. In really any other country around the world, they would be part of a different political party. And the same thing could be said among the Republican Party. You really have a few different streams of that party today that are corralled into one group. And it's really only because in our political system, the only path to victory today is through one of those two parties. That's unique among democracies. Most democracies have more than two parties. Most democracies have proportional representation in some way. We are among a very small number of countries around the world that have such a divided and polarizing political system.
The guest is Neil Simon. The new book is called Contract to Unite America, 10 Reforms to Reclaim Our Republic, published by Real Clear Publishing. Neil, to this third party thing and breaking the grip, was it a, did the two-party system dodge a real bullet when Ross Perot several years ago, who was doing very well, dropped out of that race? Did the two, the bosses of the two parties sit back and towel off the sweat they had going or not?
Well, interestingly, the reaction to that was to put up larger barriers to third parties and independents. So since that election, we've had the creation of something called the CPD, the Committee for Presidential Debates. And the hurdle for anyone to be included in a presidential debate is now polling at 15%, which is a really, really high number. Most people estimate it would take at least $250 million to get the name identification and polling up to the point where you can be included in the debate. Before that, the debates were controlled by the League of Women Voters, and you were able to have independents included. And Ross Perot, as you know, was included in one set of presidential debates. So they've raised that barrier. The parties, when they're conducting debates within their own parties for their primaries, the thresholds start at 1% and go to 2 and 3%. But for the general election, they're doing a lot to exclude other candidates. They also do a lot to make it difficult to get listed on the ballot in the general election. And not just for president, but even for statewide offices like the one I ran for. I ran for the United States Senate in Maryland, and we had to collect signatures to get on the ballot, and it's thousands of signatures. It's a difficult process, and in many states around the country, the two parties work together to continually raise that barrier to make it almost impossible for anyone even to be listed on the ballot, let alone compete.
The name of the book is Contract to Unite America, 10 Reforms to Reclaim Our Republic. The author is Ross Simon. Check that, Neil Simon. The author is Neil Simon. Back with more after we check traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we continue here on Connecticut Today. Paul Pacelli, your host, and the guest is Neil Simon, Contract to Unite America, 10 Reforms to Reclaim Our Republic. He's a former independent U.S. Senate candidate in Maryland, and he's issuing some of his thoughts on what to do, how to fix the American political system, how difficult it is to get different voices in there. Neil, do you out and out propose that we go to something akin to the European elections and elections we see in other countries, say like the UK or Israel or Germany, where many, many parties can run, and the idea would be then to form coalitions? Would that be a good idea here or not?
No, so I don't go as far as proposing a parliamentarian system or a purely proportional democratic system. I propose a set of reforms to our current system that are all supported by at least 60% of Americans. So they include things like opening our primaries and campaign finance reform, using ranked choice voting, term limits, and a few others that collectively would change the incentive structure. You know, right now, if you're a rational person running for the House of Representatives or running for the United States Senate, your only incentive is to appeal to the base of the Republican Party or the base of the Democratic Party. 70% of Senate races and 90% of House races are determined in the primary. The general election is not competitive. So your motivation is to appeal to the primary voters who tend to be the most partisan, most ideologically driven, and that's what you go to sleep thinking about every night. How can I be elected by those voters? How can I be reelected by the voters? So the incentives, the reforms that I propose are really about changing that incentive structure so that our politicians will have more reason to work together, to collaborate, maybe even compromise something that is now viewed as a dirty word, and not just appeal to the visceral desires of their base.
You mentioned, Neil, the ranked choice voting system. I have had a couple of state politicians here in Connecticut on the show to talk about that. And I guess the state of Maine, if I recall correctly here, the state of Maine is in the process of trying this. How, if you can basically, again, we've talked about it here on the show, but if you can basically explain ranked choice voting and why you think it's a good idea.
So the way ranked choice voting works is exactly how it sounds. If you have four candidates in a race, rather than just cast one vote, you rank the four candidates. And after the initial votes are tallied, if nobody has 51% of the vote, then whoever came in last place is eliminated from the contest. And then whoever voted for that last place contender, now all those second place votes are counted. And you do that until somebody gets more than 50% of the vote. So it's a really efficient way for voters to express their choice better than what we do today, which is called first-past-the-post voting. It would have been great to have that in Iowa yesterday, wouldn't it?
Oh, my God. You know, I have so many thoughts just ping-ponging, Neil, around my brain on that. But I think and I think you'd agree with me, what, as you and I are recording this and there's still a lot of doubt as to who really won, what the results are, this is the exact kind of thing, Neil, that makes the average American, who might not be really awash in this stuff as you and I are, makes the average American sit back in their easy chair, you know, shake their head, you know, and get the clicker and turn on wrestling. You know what I mean? It's sad. It really is.
It is. And the last thing this country needs is for Americans to be losing more faith in our democratic processes. So it is sad. You know, most people don't know that until 1968, most primary elections were conducted through caucuses. And it's only during the 70s when we transitioned from caucuses to primaries in almost all the states. One of the advantages of the caucus system is supposed to be that voters' choice is better expressed. So in the same way that I described it in ranked choice voting, in caucuses, if no one has a majority, then what happens is little by little, you try to convince the supporters of some of the second-tier candidates to join your group. That's basically what happens in ranked choice voting, but in a much more systematic and efficient and transparent way, where people can keep their vote private as opposed to caucuses, where it's all done in a very public way.
The name of the book is Contract to Unite America, 10 Reforms to Reclaim Our Republic. Neil Simon is the guest. Neil, ballot access laws and fundraising, I know those are always pointed to by people who say what you say, how difficult it is to get other voices in the political process here.
So ballot access laws, most people don't understand much about that. So what we're talking about there is, what are the requirements to be listed on the ballot in the general election? And both parties play games there to reduce the amount of competition. So about 6 months ago, there was a lot of press when Stacey Abrams in Georgia said that she was wrongfully denied the governorship because voters weren't counted if their names did not exactly match the registry. So she used an example of a guy named Alejandro Del Rio, and he'd either had a space between the Del and the Rio or not, and he wasn't allowed to register and to participate in the election. Well, that's true, and the Republicans did everything they could there to press their advantage, but the Democrats do the same thing. In my state, which is a Democratic-controlled state, I ran as an independent, and in order to be listed on the ballot, we needed 10,000 signatures. We submitted 17,000. 6,000 were eliminated for exactly the reasons that Stacey Abrams talked about. So neither party is innocent here. Both parties press their advantage in every way they can. And ballot access is one of the most obvious ways that they try to prevent new entrants, try to prevent competition from independents or third parties.
And, Neil, there's always the question of campaign financing, of soft money and dark money. People always rail against that sort of thing. It's mind-boggling that that still goes on. But do you really think that's going to change? It seems to me that both sides, Neil, have a vested interest in doing nothing.
The system, Paul, is so broken, the campaign finance system. And I knew it was broken before I ran, but as a candidate, I discovered just how warped it is and the role of dark money and the ability for organizations to contribute limitless amounts to campaigns. And America knows it's broken and that we have to fix it. So I proposed two specific reforms to help do that. One is about transparency. I think Americans deserve to know where money is coming from that's spent on campaigns. And the other is just saying that corporations are not people and that the federal and state governments should be allowed to set limits on the amount of money that's spent in campaigns. The system has really spiraled out of control. And the truth is that when you look at the legislation that's come out of Congress in the last few decades, there were professors at Princeton and Northwestern that did a study on this. You look at the impact that it has had on your average American. The answer is it's statistically close to zero. So we are accomplishing nearly nothing for the average American. But what we are doing is accomplishing a lot for the special interests that fund campaigns. It's a horribly broken system. And that contributes to the divisiveness as well, because I was a candidate. I got questionnaires from, say, conservation groups and also business-oriented groups. Mm-hmm. And I happen to be a pro-business guy who also thinks climate change is real and we should do things to protect our environment. I could not check all the boxes on either of those questionnaires. So for someone like me, there's no money available. You need to be dogmatic in your support for one side of an issue or another in order to attract PAC money. So it's a big part of the problem that we have, and we've got to do something to fix it.
The name of the book, Contract to Unite America, 10 Reforms to Reclaim Our Republic, published by Real Clear Publishing. The guest has been Neil Simon, a former independent candidate for U.S. Senate. Neil, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it, and good luck.
Thanks, Paul. It's been fun.
And on that, what's ahead in New Hampshire and the State of the Union tonight? One of our go-to guys who I'm guessing had a big bowl of popcorn out last night, maybe his favorite beverage, Dr. Gary Rose, Fairfield, Sacred Heart University, Fairfield. Gary, how are you?
Hey, Paul. How are you? Doing well.
How late did you stay up last night? When did you call it quits, Gary?
Yeah, I stayed up very late, actually, and I was watching caucuses on TV and just waiting for the results, which never came, and I think it was probably around 10:30, 11 o'clock, it became clear that they would not be announced. And so I went to bed, and I was hoping to wake up this morning to a set of results, and they're still not there.
You know, listen, when you step back, Gary, it is only Iowa. Yeah, it has its symbolism. It's not a heck of a lot of delegates. But, my God, you talk about a car wreck that you slow down and look at on the Merritt Parkway. I mean, this is – how could they have done this, rolling out this app that now their party boss says, well, we really didn't test it out beforehand? I mean, this Gary, is mind-boggling.
It really is, and it really does call into question the ongoing place of the Iowa caucus within the whole context of the presidential selection system. And I am sure that, in fact, already I know there are all kinds of calls for ending Iowa as the kickoff contest in this, in this whole system that we've developed. And it's and I understand it because, you know, first of all, I mean, the state is not a representative state of the country. That in itself has always been criticized, you know, but now to really fail to calculate the delegates properly and to have this new app that they developed crash last night and then the phone lines were all tied up. There's just no excuse for this, and I think we really do need to consider whether or not Iowa should be the first contest in the presidential selection process.
And Gary, as things go now with social media, I mean, almost immediately when we heard last night that this was going to get a little gamey, and who knows when we're getting that stuff, they say within the hour at 5 o'clock, but there were also these social media memes and all these memes floating around. Well, these are the people that want to run your health care. And you know what, Gary? If I was on the other side, I would have said, yeah, let's go with it. The messaging is just horrible here.
Yeah, I mean, really, there are some very valid complaints now and valid concerns about a lot of the proposals that are being, you know, presented by the Democrats, when in fact we see, you know, what happened in Iowa. I know that that's not a whole statement about the Democratic Party, and I'm not here to criticize the Democratic Party, but it does make you wonder if, in fact, they can't organize a caucus and calculate votes properly, how on earth are they going to run a national health care system for 330 million people?
Yeah,
it's
and
really a valid concern.
You know,
really,
Gary, the entire caucus system, and I know that, you know, prior to the late 60s or early 70s, most states did caucuses. They the primary thing is a relatively recent thing in most states. What are your feelings on that? It sounds very quaint, but I had a caller earlier who voiced something that's interesting, Gary, and you probably have talked about this. The fact that, for example, in Iowa, if the initial ballot puts you below 15%, you're not considered viable or strong enough. I mean, in a multi-person field, Gary, 15% ain't bad.
No, I know. A lot of states have been ending their caucuses and going to primaries, and I think we're going to see more of that, you know, in the next 4 years too. Caucuses are there's a lot to be said for caucuses because they really are face-to-face contests. They're about as grassroots as you can get, and you actually have to, you know, you have individuals who make speeches on behalf of candidates, and you have people coaxing, you know, actually some of their neighbors to join them in a group. And I like a caucus because it really is a like I said, it's probably about as democratic, if you will, as you can get within this whole system that we have of picking a party's nominee. But at the same time, turnout, generally speaking, is lower than a primary contest. I mean, it's normally high in Iowa, but the turnout in a typical caucus has been pretty low. And that troubles me. And a primary is not always, you know, characterized by high turnout either, extremely high, but certainly more voters show up for a primary than a caucus. And for that reason, I lean towards the primary system. I really do. And you know, Connecticut, as you mentioned too, you know, Connecticut used to be a caucus state, and then we went to a primary, and it's a way of getting more people to participate, I think. And a caucus takes a little more work. It really does. It's a beautiful thing when it works well, but my concern with the caucus is simply the turnout level, and I think we need to have a system in place that gets as many people involved as possible, and I don't think a caucus lends itself to that.
The numbers came out, those hidden Des Moines Register numbers were finally leaked over the weekend. To no one's surprise, Bernie Sanders did finish on top in that poll at 22%, so however well he does with these caucus numbers, it's meant to be seen. So you look at that, Gary, you look at the fact now that, you know, they're doing everything to let Michael Bloomberg appear in the next debate. He's spending his money like crazy. Are the Dems trying to kneecap Bernie here for another cycle?
Yeah, everyone has been suggesting that, and it is true that during the last Democratic nominating contest, there was, as you say, some kneecapping that went on as well. And it does make you wonder, allowing Bloomberg to get on the debate stage, although actually the original rules did say that once the process starts, then it really is the polling number that really will matter. And so I'm not sure they actually changed the rules. At first, I thought they did, but I've been looking into that. And then, you know, some have suggested, too, that by bringing, you know, Michael Bloomberg into the debate stage and allowing him to have a more prominent role now in the process is really a way to really derail Bernie Sanders' campaign. And it's really considered insurance if Biden is going down, which maybe he is. And so, you know, I don't like the fact that he has such unlimited wealth. But at the same time, when somebody is polling, as he is, around 10%, I mean, I guess he really should be on the stage debating, and he's spending millions on ads.
Oh my God!
So why not have him? Why not have him up there? I understand the argument from the Sanders campaign and campaigns of others that hey, this guy is just buying his way onto the stage and into the process. But at the same time, it's not like he's polling 1%. His poll numbers are rising, so I would say yes, let's put him on the stage.
Dr. Gary Rose is the guest, chairman of the Poli-Sci Department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Gary, hang on. We'll be back to you after traffic and weather together on the sixes here. 4:16 coming up to that on WICC. And we're at 4:17, almost 4:18 right here. It's Connecticut Today for a Tuesday right here on WICC 600 on the radio and online at WICC600.com. One of our frequent guests, we always appreciate his time, Dr. Gary Rose, chairs the Political Science Department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, watching politics all around the world, the U.S., and here in Connecticut. Well, Gary, a guy named Donald Trump is going to deliver the State of the Union tonight after being battered for weeks and months. A vote likely to acquit him in the Senate tomorrow. Democrats speaking as though the guy is Satan. Republicans saying, yeah, but he's our Satan. And you wake up this morning, Gary, and I see from Gallup, I get all of Gallup's polling data pushed to my accounts. And the president wakes up with another increase, Gary, in his job approval numbers. He's now up to 49%. What is going on?
I know. First of all, it really is somewhat surreal to think that we're going to have an impeached president. He has not been acquitted yet. He will be acquitted tomorrow. But we're going to have an impeached president delivering a State of the Union address. This is really just amazing.
With better poll numbers. What's going on? What do you think is going on?
Well, this impeachment is working against the Democrats. And now, again, 49% is not extraordinary, still slightly under half. But at the same time, his numbers have risen because as I think people watched not just the House, you know, impeachment hearings, but also the trial in the Senate. I think that, quite frankly, the president's attorneys presented such a compelling case on behalf of Trump and in favor of acquittal, that I think that the viewing public probably said, well, you know, something actually, Trump is maybe a little better of a president than we thought, and as well as a number of things that are happening out here in our country, the economy and in foreign policy and a whole number of other areas, tax cuts and so forth. I think people are probably starting to think, you know, Trump is really not as bad of a person as perhaps, you know, we originally had thought. And so his numbers are rising. But I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that the whole impeachment and the trial system worked on his behalf.
And, you know, Gary, you still see, and we saw it with the Bolton book and these anonymous books come out. You know, I'm not one when I do these shows to buy into all this conspiracy and deep state stuff, Gary. But there seem to be these body punches being laid on Mr. Trump from a lot of these people that maybe, Gary, are not happy that long after Trump has gone, whether it's this November or 4 years from now, he will have, and I hate to use this corporate word, but he will have initiated some paradigm shift here in D.C., which I get the opinion not a whole lot of people are going to be in favor of.
Yeah, I think there is a paradigm shift. This whole notion of a disruptor, you know, showing up in D.C. as he did and draining the swamp, even though the swamp hasn't been completely drained, it really has, I think, affected the future of a number of people who just are so integral to the lifeblood of the Beltway, and they're probably I think, really thinking about their own future and what this means. I would agree with you on that, Paul.
Gary, so before we get to the state issues here, one or two issues I wanted to bring up north, because you have written and watched extensively on the state stuff. If you are the other candidates now, with New Hampshire coming up next week, which I guess the forecasts say Bernie Sanders may likely win, if you're Bernie Sanders, if you're Pete Buttigieg, if you're Elizabeth Warren, what do you do if you're strategizing, as a famous ex-president used to say, got to strategize there. What's the tack now for New Hampshire and going forward?
Well, you know, New Hampshire is an interesting state when it comes to a primary, because it's a semi-open primary, and you do allow unaffiliated voters to join one party or the other. And in this case, you know, obviously you're going to have a substantial number of independents up there in New Hampshire voting. And so New Hampshire really has always been far more than, I mean, even though you had to finish in the top three in Iowa, although we've McCain and actually Bill Clinton finished fourth, but depending on with Clinton, it depends on how you look at that. But you have to finish in the top two in New Hampshire, and it's very difficult to move forward if you finish third or fourth in New Hampshire. So I think there's an awful lot more at stake in next week's contest than there was in Iowa. And not only that, with the debacle in Iowa, I mean, who knows how this is going to be interpreted. Yeah. But I think the New Hampshire primary, they do a great job up there. It's retail politics. And if you don't finish in the top two, and if you finish three, four, or fifth, your campaign could very well be over. Although I will say that in Biden's case, he may not finish in the top two, but nevertheless, I think South Carolina and Nevada could help Biden reset his campaign. But nevertheless, coming out of New Hampshire, really, you've got to have that momentum. Otherwise, you are in trouble.
And finally, Gary, and we know that you also write extensively and observe state politics as well. You know, this special, and I'm sorry, no special session, because the will for that wasn't there. This short session coming up in a few days. It seems like Governor Lamont is, listen, to his credit, he believes what he believes. He is seen bent on getting some sort of toll legislation here. Both caucuses come out, House and Senate, saying, oh, we're behind him. But then when you ask them if they have the votes, they kind of say, we'll get back to you. And neither side wants to go first. How do you assess this whole situation here? And do you think that there are leaders on both caucuses just wondering, praying, asking the governor to, be quiet on this until Election Day comes?
Yeah, well, that's really, you hit the nail on the head. It has so much to do with electoral consequences. And if you look at public opinion here in the state, support for tolling trucks only has risen somewhat, but it is still not really a public that is very enthusiastic about tolling. And so I completely agree with you, Paul, that that the leaders of the caucuses, as you say, in the House and the Senate, and certainly the governor's party, is really, I think, you know, maybe they can speak publicly about maybe the need for it, but when it comes to actually start voting, a number of them, I am convinced, are going to get cold feet and say, let's hold off on this, because out there in all of these districts that we have, these 151 districts, you know, for the House and the 36 senatorial districts, there are a lot of people that do not want tolls.
Is this just finally, Gary, is this just Ned Lamont saying, listen, I was elected, I'm not a creature of this building or of your party, I'm pushing for what I think is right? Do you think there's something there with that?
Yeah, well, you know, Ned Lamont, I would agree with that. He certainly feels that we need tolls, and we do have a real problem with infrastructure in this state, and the Special Transportation Fund needs help. So I think that Ned, I think that when he became governor, he started to learn about the politics of the legislature, and to some extent, he was probably really taken aback at how political the process truly is. But nevertheless, having watched Ned, I think he's a man of convictions, and he believes he's doing the right thing. But I think he's also realizing very quickly that, even if you feel strongly about a particular policy issue, the politics and what goes on out there, you know, all politics is local out there among the districts. that really has a tremendous impact on whether or not he can legislate this.
Gary, thanks. In fact, I just got a bulletin in here that as far as these Iowa results, they're going to start using smoke signals sometime after 5 o'clock. So open your... So if you're home or at your office there at Sacred Heart, just see if it's white. You know what they're going to do? It's going to be like a papal election, Gary. White smoke or black smoke.
Oh,
you know,
brother.
There'll be some Latin mixed in there, some Gregorian chants. It'll be all good. Gary, thanks. We appreciate it.
Okay, Paul. All right.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.